Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hey there, welcome again to Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. This week, we are talking about the first half of the series finale of The Prisoner, entitled Once Upon a Time. I make mention of a BBC production of a play called Brand that Patrick McGoohan starred in 1959, and I'll have a YouTube link to it in the notes, the show notes, at backinthevillage.com. You should definitely check it out. It's a very intense performance, as if you would expect anything else from him. But that's about it, so enjoy Once Upon a Time. Good morning, good morning. I hope you enjoyed that brief break last week with our coverage of Danger Man, because this week we are back talking about The Prisoner on Back in the Village, the Prisoner Podcast. I am Clay McCormick from EatDeadMeat.com, and with me, as always, is Wes Teasdale from The Penske File. How are you doing, Wes?
Good, Clay. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad.
You had an exciting weekend?
I did. My voice might be a little ragged because I was in New York at a comic convention for 2 days yelling at people from across the table. So
it's exactly like Chasing Amy, I'm assuming.
Oh, no. Yeah. People refer to inkers as tracers, and then there's fist fights, and there's weird sexual politics.
If he drew it, and you're drawing a line over exactly what he drew.
Hey, man, fuck you. But that's not neither here nor there, because today we are talking about the I believe the term is penultimate episode of the series we're covering, The Prisoner, which is titled Once Upon a Time.
Exactly.
Degree absolute. I require approval.
Unlike me, many of you have accepted the situation of your imprisonment and will die here like rotten cabbages.
If you think he's that important, there's certainly no other alternative. You must risk either one of us.
Who's standing beside you now? I intend to discover who are the prisoners and who are the warders.
I am a good man. I was a good man, but if you get him, he will be better, and there's no other way. I repeat, no other way.
I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned.
Degree absolute. Tonight, please.
I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered.
A week? That's not long enough. You don't want to damage him.
My life is my own.
Very well. Tonight.
It was written and directed by Patrick McGoohan, although it was originally attributed to Archibald Schwartz, which is a pseudonym that McGoohan used because he was afraid that people were going to ridicule the script.
Okay.
And if you've seen the episode, you might be able to see why. That's not a comment on my thoughts about the episode. It's just if you were to read that script, you would probably throw it in the trash.
Yep.
Again, not a comment on its quality, just, you know, looking, it's basically pages of people yelling numbers at
each
other.
Right, words on the page. Just like, I kind of agree. Adam Carolla always talks about, Napoleon Dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, who read that script and was like, this is going to be a good movie? If you were to read that script, you'd be like, this is nonsense and I don't understand anything that these guys are talking about.
I found I'm really bad at that. The few times that I've read scripts, even from movies that I know like turned out to be really great, I read the script and I go, this is terrible. I don't know who this Vito Corleone guy is, but he is a bad character.
On the waterfront. What waterfront?
There's not even any boats. There's not even a boat chase in this movie. Anyway, our number two this week is the returning Leo McKern, who I am, for one, happy to see back because he is my favorite number two.
Sure.
Right away, it's whereas we've had a returning number two in the past, this is the first time that they've actively returned a number two.
Yeah, his return is like part of the show is acknowledging that he's coming back.
Right, right. Previously, we had Colin Gordon, who was in A, B, and C, and The General.
Yeah.
And there's no mention of him
And the way that it was broadcast, there were other episodes in between.
Right.
But they were actually shot back to back. You know, we've talked about all that before. So there's no mention of him either coming or going at the end of or beginning of either of those episodes. But right. this one is he's brought back very purposefully.
Yep.
And so basically the breakdown of this episode is number six has pushed the village to its limits. And so they bring back number two because he seemed to be, I mean, he's the closest they've come to actually breaking him.
Yeah, he's one of their all-stars, I guess.
Yeah, he was obviously, of course, the number two in Chimes of Big Ben, which as far as getting him to say why he resigned, I believe it's the only time where he says, I resigned because .. And then the whole thing falls apart. So by those standards, he's the most successful number two.
Yep. Least successful, the bedtime story.
Yes,
two.
By far.
He should have just assumed the role of the butler in this one.
They should have just let the butler, you know, run things that week.
If the butler's number one, that'll be very disappointing. I will have to admit that. So they bring back number two. This guy, he has a shouty, pseudo nervous breakdown phone call with somebody,
right? We can only assume is probably number one.
Number one, yep.
And they decide on this basically last ditch effort protocol called Degree Absolute, which puts six and two in a room together for a week, and they basically it involves some sort of mind wiping thing that brings six back to the mindset of an infant.
Yep.
And then basically follows the seven stages of man back up through his life, really laying into certain stressful and high intensity aspects of his life to try and they talk about it later as saying number two is trying to get number six to trust him so he would open up to him.
Yeah.
But it never really felt like that. It felt like more like they were pinpointing kind of stressful points in Six's life to kind of frazzle him and then jump in with, why did you resign?
Yeah, I thought they were just trying to drive him crazy, sort of, to the point where he'd admit what he had done.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't seem like, I didn't get the impression they were trying to be friends with him. He was sort of...
Yeah, I didn't either.
Okay, yeah.
That's what I've... I mean, they kind of say that in the episode, and I've read people describe it that way, but I the way I read it was more like, you know, all of these incidents that they bring up are very stressful, kind of character-building moments.
Yeah.
And I was reading it as they were using those... digging into those moments as a way to try and knock something loose,
right? Yeah,
to explain Six's character or why he resigned,
right?
I think we can get into it a bit later, but number two is a little bit trigger happy in his techniques because
how so?
Well, he does a good job of like getting into these specific moments,
yeah.
But then as soon as there's a little glimmer of Six starting to crack.
Yep.
He just goes, why'd you resign? Just tell me right now. Just tell me, why'd you resign?
Oh, I see. Well, he's very, I guess it ties in with his, because his opening phone call with number one, who we're assuming is very frazzled as well. He seems like the, mm-hmm. I think what you were saying, you know, the village is at their wit's end. Everything seems to be very tense. And yeah, he is trigger happy, but I guess it's really just their urgency for whatever reason they need to do this now and this needs to happen.
And they make it clear before this all starts that basically this is like Thunderdome. One of them is two men enter and one man leaves.
Yeah, he says that until death do we part.
Right.
He has a stretch where McKern, I think, quotes 37 different literature quotes over the span of 2 minutes. And I don't think it's he says that. He has the Shakespeare where all men are on a stage.
Yep.
Or the Rush song, whichever came first.
Yeah, Limelight. Yes, he quotes Limelight by Rush. I think his frustration and his rushing is because Six is very much a mentally strong prisoner, obviously.
Right.
So I think he's just trying to hit him with the knockout as quickly as possible so he can get out of there without, you know, losing his mind.
Right.
Which, as you go through the episode, he's not so lucky.
No.
There is a turning point, and the tables turn, and six gets the advantage, and number two breaks mentally, just like completely shatters.
Yeah.
And
he just dies.
He drops dead. Yeah. Right at the end of the, in the last 30 seconds of the week period.
Yep.
Two drops dead, and the control guy, the bald guy, comes down and congratulates Six for making it through and asks him what he wants, and he says, "I want number one." And he said, "We'll take you to him." And then they walk out of the room, and the door closes, and that's the end of the episode.
Yeah, yep.
This is it. For better or worse. Who knows? 1 week. One teeny-weeny week, my boy. Neither of us can leave. Till death do us part.
So, what are your thoughts at the top on this one?
I like this one. I thought it was, it's a great penultimate thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you can really see it's going to close after this, or at least that's what this episode is hinting at. It had a little bit of stuff that drives me a little bit nutty. But I thought overall it was really good. It was like the surrealism of the village sort of taken to its extreme, like mm-hmm. a lot of just weird stuff where like the little butler is just shaking that like rattle thing.
Right.
And it's just like kind of weird and not for any particular reason. He's just going like,
right.
like that in the background. I liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was, the performances were really good. Those two are excellent. I'll have a lot of criticism, I think, of just sort of weird things that happen, but the, my last point was basically just going to say that I thought it was really strong, and I can see what they're trying to do with mm-hmm. it. Like, this is the crescendo of what the whole show has yeah. kind of been about.
Yeah, yeah. I love this episode. I think so. One of the things that's interesting, it's interesting to talk about this at the front because I think it's just very odd. Is that this episode was shot sixth.
Yeah.
So that's why at the beginning, number two is watching sort of a montage of number six's greatest hits of being an asshole.
And they're all early.
Yeah, they're
early
all
run.
From the first five episodes, with the exception of Checkmate. There's no shots from Checkmate. And I've read that this was written and shot to be the cliffhanger season finale of the first season.
Okay.
Before, when they were still planning on doing 26 episodes, before it got cut to 17.
Right.
But I don't know how you, like, at the end of this episode, he number two drops dead. Number six is basically declared the winner of the village.
Yeah.
To an extent. And then it ends with him being brought off to see number one. I mean, I...
yeah, I could... I guess I could see it, because... all they'd have to do is sort of do the flip where you're like, oh, you're not really going to meet number one.
Yeah.
The twos, I don't see the twos. I think the two dying is sort of more symbolic than anything, because I'd assume maybe other twos have died in the past and mm-hmm. they just replaced them as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only two we've actually seen die though, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, it's sort of important that that's happened. And that you can take it like symbolically to be like, this is the end of the twos run, all of them collectively. Yeah. I could see it as being a end of a season episode. Did they know what shows were going to come in season two at that point, or were they just...
No, I don't think so.
Right,
I think it was shot sixth, and the ones that were quote-unquote season two shows were Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling, Living in Harmony, and The Girl Who Would Be Death, which were all shot 13, 14, and 15.
Right, but at that point, they were struggling to just finish those shows, right? Those weren't like planned, or were they planned to be
those,
the second season?
Yeah, those. But by the time they got around to shooting those, they were thinking those were going to be for season two. And so when they got the axe, they kind of had to wrap it up quickly.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
And the other reason why it's very strange to me that this was shot sixth is because it is such, I find it such a natural in the line of the progression of Six's character we've been talking about, of like where it is in the run is perfectly representative of the change of Six's character.
Yeah.
Because at the very beginning of the episode, which I do really like, again, this is directed by McGoohan, and I think it plays to all of his strengths. And I think I read that he wrote this episode in 36 hours.
Yeah.
And the kind of genius thing that he did is he basically turns it into a play.
Yeah.
And right from the start, you get theater imagery where we go into number two's office, and Rover is in the number two chair.
Yeah.
For some reason.
He fits perfectly.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's kind of implying a bit that, you know, because number two comes up out of the ground and Rover is sitting in his chair. It kind of implies that not even number two is even for as much power as number two has, he's still an inmate in the village.
Yeah, yeah.
And but in that scene, one of the very first thing we see is a very theatrical looking curtain set opening to reveal the monitor screen.
Yep.
Which I went back and I specifically looked for this. In previous episodes, there are times where the screen has curtains,
yep,
but never that ornate. Those are very specifically meant to look like theater curtains.
Okay.
And that first shot really is a setup for the whole style that he presents the episode in, which is, you know, basically like a black box theater play.
Right, yep.
Or maybe a little bit more than a black box theater play, because there is a decent amount of set dressing. But it's basically a play in one room.
Yep, a one-man show.
With all different sets.
With two guys, yeah.
Yeah, a one-man show with two guys. And, you know, there's, like you said, there's references to, there's the Shakespeare quote, and, you know, I think there might be one or two other things in there that reference the theatrical aspect of it.
Yep.
But McGoohan clearly leaned heavily on his past as a theater actor to play to his strengths in writing and acting this episode, and just turned it into two guys acting their asses off for an hour.
Yep, yep.
And allowing that setting to play into the aesthetic of the village, and also give you really more information about Six than we've ever seen before, minus, you know, Forsake Me, My Darling.
Mm-hmm.
Not
canon.
Yeah, but not deliberately and not clearly. So as he goes through these different stages, assuming that what they're doing to him is reliving aspects of his life, we see number six at school. We can infer a little bit about his home life.
Yep.
Training for in fencing and boxing.
Oh, right.
Going on a job interview. I have some thoughts about the job interview portion. learning that he was involved in some sort of traffic accident that killed people, which I also have some thoughts about.
Filling out the forms for his
accident. Being sent to jail. Finding out that his job is actually a cover for some sort of state secret thing.
Mm-hmm.
Learning that he was a RAF bomber in World War II. I guess it would be World War II. Learning that he had to bail out over Germany and was in German captivity for a while. Assuming all of that actually happened.
Right, yeah.
I have some thoughts about it. I think you can look at it either way. What did you think about that stuff?
About whether or not it actually happened? Just
about the way that, whether or not it actually was stuff that actually happened to Six, or my thought is some of it is probably just kind of catch-alls, or I don't know if I want to say metaphors, but...
Yeah, I would prefer it's not all sort of true.
Yeah.
Just because I think the mystery of things that aren't true seem to suit the show better.
Right.
Is that... now I'm having to remember. When does Six snap... Is that before or after he snaps out of this kind of trance thing that they put him in? Does he start remembering this before that happens? Or is that at the end when he... I'm trying to remember if there's a specific moment where he breaks back.
Well, he starts to kick out of the treatment.
Yes.
Every time they say the number six, or any time they ask him when he resigns.
Right.
So that's when you can see him fighting back. And even when he's fighting back, he's fighting back in a very primitive way. Like, he can't really, his brain can't fully take control.
Yep.
And so the first time, number two is trying to get him to fall in line by their, you know, counting up or doing multiplication. And every time they get the six, he won't say it. He just gets right. six, yeah. six, yeah. six. And then, you know, number six, his mind is kind of getting frazzled. Then he just punches punches him in the face.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, jumps on him and starts choking him out. And then the butler has to knock him out. And I think at that point he had gone through like high school.
Yep.
Or something.
Okay.
But after he breaks out and starts choking number two, they have to send him back.
Right. They put him back on the table and do that thing again. Yeah. So you're right. I would hope it's kind of a mix of not happening, maybe lightly dusted with, like you're saying, like a metaphor for just things that could have happened in the past. It's not, I don't even think it really, does it matter? It's not really all that relevant to what they accomplish, because at that point it's kind of just the two minds sort of battling it out to see what happens.
Yeah.
So whether or not these things actually happened, I'd prefer that they didn't, but I suppose it doesn't really ultimately matter.
Yeah. I prefer to think that pretty much what you're saying, like there's a thread of truth in there, but if you were to go in and be like, well, we learned that number six killed some people with his car.
Right.
I wouldn't go that far, because I watching it this time, I was reading that as, well, you could kind of apply that to being a scenario in which Six is having to deal with any killing that he's done in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
Or any innocent people that he's harmed in the name of whatever his top secret job is. Which I think to be the more interesting answer.
Yeah.
And it's in that sort of structure that I think that this episode is so brilliantly put together.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you resign?
For peace.
Yeah, let me out. You resigned for peace?
Yes, let me out.
You're a fool.
For peace of mind.
What?
For peace of mind!
Why?
Because too many people know too much.
Never.
I know too much.
Tell me.
I know too much about you.
The number one thing that McGoohan does in this show, whenever he's really given the reins to it, is to subvert what you, give you what you want, but not realize that's what you're getting. So I think the interesting thing overall about this episode is you basically learn why number six resigns. But he doesn't come out and say, I resigned because. It's all a matter of, you have to watch what they're doing and watch the scenarios they're playing out.
Yeah.
And in the way he's responding and in the things they're doing, you can kind of piece together at least an idea of what made him leave.
Yeah. I mean, the bluntest he gets is he says he has a crisis of conscience or something. He has something along those lines.
He mentions he resigned for peace of mind.
Peace of mind. That's it. Yeah.
And, because too many people know too much.
Right. Yeah.
And which is still pretty vague, but yep. I mean, that's the closest that he gets to flat out telling you.
Right. Yeah. And I guess we kind of knew that. Judging by the way that he resigns in the intro, like the introduction of every episode,
right,
where he's like
right.
slamming his fists, and so you can kind of assume that he's doing this because he's upset with what's going on. But yeah, he doesn't flat out do it, doesn't need it, as we've learned, and it's a nice little denouement or whatever to his story at that point. It's clever. It's nice to flip the table, show everything that he's been undergoing and actually not actually nail the points, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Like it is very theatrical in that way. It's sort of broad without getting specific, because you can't get too specific in theater like
right,
that. It doesn't
right.
really work.
Yeah, and I kind of went off a bit to talk about the theater angle when I started talking about number six's character, but when we start this episode, number six has taken as we talked about at the end of The Girl Who Was Death, the end of that episode, you get the feeling that number six has taken the teeth away from the village completely.
Right.
And at the beginning of this episode, you get the same feeling. And they get that across as well, because when number two calls him on, you know, asks him why he cares, and he says, "Oh, you'll never know." Like, yep. You know, it's like, I know something you know. It's very childish.
They're going to have to replace that carpet in his house. He walks that path thousands of times a day.
Yeah, pacing like a caged lion.
Yeah, and like nibbling on crackers or something.
But after the phone call, he goes to leave, and the door opens, and when he leaves, he gives a little clap to shut the door. And then after, right after that, he goes up to some random villager and, in a great play on words, says, "How?" Like the, you know, old stereotypical Indian way of saying hello.
Yep.
But he's asking a question. So the villager freaks out. And he's like, "No, you can't inquire about things." You know. So he's completely, he basically has broken whatever hold the village has on him.
Yeah.
And is just continuously taking the piss out of it.
Yep, yep.
Which is, you know, probably why they feel the need to go to this degree. When I was watching it this time, I couldn't decide for a minute whether or not the decision to go to degree absolute was the number one's decision or number two's. Because it's weird, because the way I kind of read it this time was that the village almost was going to choose to ignore him or something.
Oh,
just because they only gave him a week, only gave number two a week to do it, and he's like, "That's nowhere near enough time. You don't want to break him. You want to,
right?
You know."
Yeah, I guess they did give him time. I got the impression it was two has some line where he's like, "I told you I had to do it my way."
Yeah,
and this is. Maybe they didn't give him enough time to get the job he wanted done, but
yeah, maybe it's that. Maybe it's, you know, sort of like, all right, we're gonna let you do it, but under our terms.
Right, you do whatever you want, but you have a week to get it done instead of anything else. And, you know, you can tell it's kind of hastily thrown together, because when they give you a week, they give him a clock, which is somehow going to be like a calendar. I just thought that was funny.
I don't know how that clock works.
He's like, "We're going to be here for a week, six," and then he spins the dial and pulls the thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think a calendar with some days would have worked better.
"Behold the clock! 5 minutes! Set to open on a new phase of our relationship."
But yeah, so Six has very clearly gotten to the point where he does not fear the village whatsoever. The village has turned into, it seems like the village has turned into, for him, the technicolored nursery rhyme kind of place that it seems.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to drop the hammer on him in the most extreme way possible.
Yep.
So how did you feel about number two, his performance throughout? Because I think it doesn't stand out immediately how well the arc is written in this episode.
Sure.
But I thought he was really good.
Yeah, I thought they were both good. I think I was reading he had like a breakdown or something.
Yeah. So apparently
he looks like he's going to die in virtually every single close-up that they film of him. He's, like, sweating.
Yes.
And it looks like his heart is about to explode.
Yeah, I read that from multiple sources that at a certain point, the acting aspect fell away, and the two of them just basically became the characters.
Yeah.
And were acting out degree absolute for real.
Yeah.
And Leo McKern, McGowan won, basically, as he is probably wont to do. Leo McKern just had a nervous breakdown, and they had to stop filming for 3 days.
Huh.
And I saw an interview where McKern refers to McGowan as a dreadful bully,
sure,
who is impossible to work with. And then at the end of that, he says, "But it was all great fun."
That's when they put the lights over his head and did the flashing thing.
Right.
I thought he was... He seemed virtually, I don't know what order this was shot in, but when they, when Two goes into Six's apartment and puts the light over his head,
mm-hmm,
and then starts like crazily reciting nursery rhymes, mm-hmm, like in a way that's, you know, crazy people aren't usually on pitch or on tone, like, yes, he's just kind of reciting it crazily. He's like, "And row, row your boat," and he's just walking backwards. And then he took his shirt off and had a shirt that was far too tight. And I was like, mm-hmm. this man has lost his mind as far as this is concerned.
Well, I always thought that scene was kind of weird. Weirdness for weirdness's sake.
Yeah.
But I read it differently this time I was watching it. And I think that plays into how well he structured throughout the episode. Because the way I was reading that this time is... first of all, he's singing Humpty Dumpty and Jack and Jill go up the hill.
Yep.
Humpty Dumpty is basically what they're going to do to number six.
Yep.
They're going to break him and then try and put him back together. and you could argue that Jack and Jill is sort of an implication of what is possible, where one of them falls down and breaks their head, and then the other one breaks as well.
Yeah.
But that's conjecture. But the thing that I liked about that scene this time when I was watching it is that franticness in which he's singing it really accented how number two knows how dangerous this procedure is.
Yeah.
And he knows that he is as much as at risk to breaking as number six is.
Yeah, yeah. I feel he's almost gone crazy at this point.
Yeah.
Just like he was frazzled from the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
He was very short with the butler.
Yeah.
Unironically. And then
ba-dum-bum.
And then he has this thing. He's just like, go with this plan. And they start crazily reciting the things. I felt he was already unhinged at this point.
Yeah.
And what six does is just kind of outlasts him. Mm-hmm. And then his mm-hmm. craziness just causes his downfall.
Yeah. I mean, that's possible too. Yeah. I mean, I just saw it as stress, really.
Right.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. Right.
The stress
yeah.
was building for what he was going to do. And I think they follow that through really well.
Yep.
Because even at the end, after six breaks him, he just completely loses it and starts, talking like an insane person.
Yep.
And rolling around on the ground and saying there's still time.
Yep.
And there's a great moment at the end where six is really getting into his face and he's, kind of recoiling and kind of rolling around trying to get away from him. And there's a point where he goes, okay, I'm back. And then he immediately goes, bah, and he just freaks out again. Like it's a nice moment where he's trying to, steal himself and bring yep. himself back, but he's way too far gone.
Yeah. Can't be done at this point.
And, he's rolling around on the ground saying there's still time. And six, I forget what six's response is. Oh, he says for me. And number two goes, no, for me. Like he's desperately trying to, even though he's already lost the battle, he's desperately still throwing punches, even though he's not hitting anything.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And, I thought it was just a great through line of that, setting him up as that he's six talks about at the end when he finally breaks him. He talks about what degree absolute is, and the idea behind it
mm-hmm.
and saying that, the danger is that the patient and the doctor, quote unquote, can flip roles if the doctor has issues of his own.
Right. Yeah.
Which, and number two is like, which I do. So I really like how, even though they don't come out at the beginning and have him be like, this is dangerous for me because of all of my issues or the things that I have, dealing,
Yep.
You get the idea that he knows what he's doing is dangerous for himself.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I totally agree with that. He's, I thought his performance was good. I thought both of them were good. I think my criticism would just be, I think it's probably personal. It's nothing like I could technically point out. I don't like the number of close-ups they do where they're both in frame. I found it obnoxious after a little while.
Okay.
And the infantilization thing, while it made sense, I think what I'm trying to say, there was a weird sort of sexual undertone that I wasn't really, because he's like, he's like, your daddy's here with you now.
Yeah.
And walking him around. Well, two is eating that ice, or six is eating the ice cream cone. It was like very, and then there's just a lot of shots of them basically real close together, like face to face.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's going to happen here? Something.
Well, I actually like those shots because I think it gives, it's a good way to get both of them on screen together.
Yeah.
Acting,
facially, I guess.
Yeah. There's I was listening to another podcast where someone was talking about Harold Ramis directing Groundhog Day.
Yep.
And he told him they were shooting the Ned Ryerson scenes.
Sure.
And they were just shooting them in two shot where it was Bill Murray and Stephen Tobolowsky. And Stephen Tobolowsky asked him, he said, are we going to go in and do any like cutaways? And Harold Ramis said, no, because comedy lives in the two shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought about that before. And the next movie I watched, which I think was the new Avengers movie, actually, I noticed a lot of the jokes were falling flat. And I realized one of the reasons was because they kept cutting away for people's reactions to the jokes.
Sure.
And it just doesn't work that way. There's a certain magic you get when you've got both people on screen together.
Right. Sure.
And for the stuff that they're doing in this episode, I think, you know, for the quickness of the responses that they're going for and, you know, like when he gets in there and he's like, what was it? Was it secret? He's like, what? State secret? You know, that kind of thing is so quick.
Yeah.
If they were, you have to be able to get in there close and get really intimate with the two actors.
Yeah.
And if you were to do that cutting back and forth, it would just, you know, even though they're, you know, inches away from each other, the fact that you're cutting makes it seem like a miles.
Yeah, yeah. And the cutting would be distracting.
And also, I don't, you're just constantly looking for a reason to call out number six's homosexuality.
It's hard to say. He has... McGoohan has a... There's something
animal magnetism.
About, animal magnetism. There's something about him I find a little bit annoying when he plays things. Like,
okay.
His business with the ice cream cone drove me a little crazy. And that's like, like he wasn't taking bites of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was just kind of like nibbling the top. And I was like, you son of a bitch, you eat that
well,
ice cream
I mean,
cone.
Honestly, it's probably because they shot that about 20 times.
Right, and he's probably ate 37 ice cream cones.
Exactly.
It's just his general... and it's really just his six character for whatever reason, because he's not like this with his other characters that he's played, like John Drake or Billie Holiday. No, not Billie Holiday. Like
Billie Holiday.
singing Strange Fruit. His John Wayne episode was not like that.
Right.
I was thinking Billy the Kid, but it came out Billie Holiday. So it's
kind of more or less the same thing.
Yeah, pretty sad. Ticked off that. The yeah, so it's something he's doing when he's choosing to play six. And sometimes I feel it grates on me a little bit. I don't know. And I think that's the close-ups are kind of an example of that. Just because he's very... It's hard to describe. There's just something about it that he's choosing to play those moments that way. And sometimes I think maybe it's too much or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know perfectly well what I'm talking about.
Why did you resign?
I can't tell you that, sir.
Was it secret?
Hmm? Secret, sir?
And confidential?
No, sir.
Top secret?
No, sir.
Top secret?
State secret?
Yes.
State secret, sir?
Top state secret confidential! Why did you resign?
So... where do you think the turning point comes in their clash of psyches, basically?
Oh, see, I probably didn't even pick up on it because not that it's repetitive, but the it's certainly a slow build.
Yeah.
For this one, I didn't really see any. I probably couldn't identify a breaking point or like a change or a switch or anything out of all the things that they did. It all kind of blended together for me. And really at the end, it just felt like Six just lasted long enough to win.
Which is,
you know, not long enough, but he did. He's going to outlast two, and that's why he won. And then he seemed fine at that point, and he's sort of back in with it. Why did you think there was a certain switch point?
Well, I was looking for it, and I think there is. I think there's a very clear point where after the scene where he's in quote-unquote German prison.
Yep.
He gets up and they do the number thing again. And when he gets to six, he says six.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after he says that, he steps out of that little prison chamber and they hit him with the spotlight.
Yep.
And he says something to the effect of, what's for dinner? And, you know,
right, sure.
And he's got this look on his face like he's, you know, he's regained himself.
Oh, I gotcha.
I think there's another smaller, or I should say the first big crack comes earlier where he's in jail the first time and they're having that back and forth between the bars. And six really starts to turn it on number two, where he starts saying, like, I know a lot about you. And two goes, who am I? And so
the power
dynamic, it changes.
Yeah.
And then at that point, two says, I'll kill you. Six says, I'll die. And then they go to open up the prison bars. Two yells at the butler and says, open it. The butler doesn't move. Six says, open it now. And the butler moves.
Yeah, that's probably.
And because later on, that dynamic persists where Six locks two into the cage, which I guess we should say the biggest part of the set in this episode is basically an RV, which it has prison bars on it, but is fully stocked and you could live in it for months, apparently. It's got food, it's got a kitchen table and a stove and a bathroom.
Yeah.
And it's on wheels and it moves.
Yeah, it was kind of a fancy version of the thing that Hannibal Lecter's put in when they're moving him. Like, he kind of has like a little desk. It's kind of a fancy upgraded version of that.
Yeah, and that's just in there. I'm not really sure why, or, you know, why they would need one that moved, but...
Right, yeah. Yeah, just set. It seems maybe set designers like, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea because it's a very
it's a symbol of the village essentially.
Yeah, it's that's a very good point. Yeah, because it's a very domesticated set of, like I said, a kitchen and a living room area.
Yeah,
but it's got bars on it like the prison.
Yeah, right.
And there's a point where Six goes to lock number two. Right after that sequence with where he's in German prison,
yep,
he's regained himself, and two is clearly snapped, and he goes to lock him in, and the butler hands him the key, hands Six the key to lock it,
yeah,
and two flips out because he's like, he answers to you now, and then that's when two starts to. There's a really interesting thing that happens. That's a very definitive, you could look at it as a very definitive win for Six. Over everything, because number two says something to the effect of, he answered, I'm number two, I'm the one in charge, and Six says, no, I am, and then that's, the way, his whole demeanor after that point is very much victorious.
Yep.
And,
he's regained himself.
Yes, he's regained himself, and he's also, the biggest downfall of the plan of Degree Absolute is putting number two in a room with number six where there's absolutely no chance of number two getting help.
Yeah.
So if number six turns the tables on him, then he's toast.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what happens.
Yep. Yep. He didn't know. I guess there's a fight scene sort of choking. I don't really consider that. He doesn't really throw many haymakers in this one.
No,
which is
there
weird.
There is technically a gratuitous ass beating. Where he breaks the first time and jumps number two and starts choking him out a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, but there's also a boxing scene and a fencing scene.
Oh, I don't count. I wouldn't count those.
You don't count sport fighting.
No, those are games, not sport. No, he's he doesn't throw any real haymakers. He chokes two, but then gets billy clubbed down pretty quickly. Or what's those things called?
Yeah, billy club. Yeah.
Are they okay?
I think so.
Yeah. Flapjack or something. It's not a flapjack.
I think the flapjack
that's
is
why
the short
flapjack.
One.
Yeah, the little. I'm thinking of like the. It's sort of like a heavy cloth. It's not cloth, but it's got
like a piece of lead in it.
That's
a flapjack.
Oh, okay.
But he's got something longer.
Oh, does
like
he?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I was just looking at my notes. The actual exchange is he thinks you're the boss now, and then Six says, "I am," and then
Tony Danza walks in and says, "No, I."
And then number two says, no, I'm number two. I'm the boss. And then number six says, number one is the boss, which is a very interesting back and forth to have.
He thinks you're the boss now.
I am.
I'm number two. I'm the boss. Open the door.
Number one is the boss.
No.
3 minutes.
But yeah, so at the end... There's number two, as we said, number two has this total mental and physical collapse, and number six uses it as an opportunity to try and get some information out of him. Nothing super pertinent, just basically about that mobile prison.
Yeah.
he's
interested in this.
Yeah.
Thing.
Well, I mean, honestly, it makes sense because if it's mobile and you can live in it for months, that would be very interesting to someone who's trying to say, I don't know, escape somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, so the last 5 minutes that they're in there together, number two just completely disintegrates. And Six and he get into this, you know, yelling match. Well, I should say Six is very calm.
Yeah.
But he's very, he is incredibly scary.
Yeah.
Like, he gets really scary. So yeah, there's a power switch that I mentioned before where when Two is in behind the bars the first time, and he does that thing where he says, I'll kill you. Two says, I'll kill you, and number Six says, I'll die.
Yep.
Then they open the thing, and number Two gets a knife, and he starts going at number Six. At that point, number Six starts saying, do it. Kill me, which is a flip of when they were having the fencing scene. And where number Two is saying, do it. You can't do it. You can't kill. Which, again, is a good, you know, metaphor. Well, I hate reusing the word metaphor, but it's like a symbolic reference to some of the issues Six had in why he resigned.
Yeah, right.
And
that's true.
After that scene where Six is telling him to kill him, when number Two drops dead, there is a voice who is saying, die, die, Six, die, die. But they don't show number Six saying it.
Wait, did it saying die number Two or die number
no,
Six?
No, it says die Six.
Oh, die Six.
Yeah, okay. It's really weird. Because so at the end, when he's starting, he's like, he's right. Like having that drink and he's starting to keel over. The voice off screen just goes, die, six, die, die, Six, die. And
die.
They don't show number die. Six saying it. And I was reading the AV die. Club review, and he actually mentioned too, there's, if you look at when they finally do show number Six at that point,
mm-hmm.
he looks kind of surprised that number Two just keeled over.
Right.
I don't know if that was intentionally to make it seem vague about who was doing it, but that whole sequence is very strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's the symbolic death of number Six as opposed to whoever that person actually is. You know what I mean? Like,
okay, that's interesting.
Because the number Six is, since the prison doesn't really exist, because he seems to have broken too, so maybe it's the death of Six.
Okay, so you're saying maybe that, so with the death of Two,
goes, Six also goes.
Six also goes.
Yeah.
I like that. I'll buy that. That's pretty cool, actually. I like that.
Whose voice is saying? Is it?
I think it's McGoohan. Okay. Because I think I'm pretty sure it is.
I remember that scene. I didn't remember. I thought they, I thought it was just shot oddly. Like maybe they didn't have the coverage, and they were like, oh, we'll just ADR this in later.
It's very possible. Yeah. So. But the AV Club reviewer says he thinks it's number One saying it, but I think it's one of those things where it really doesn't matter.
Right,
I think it's just the implication of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I like that idea that. Because you've got basically your two pillars are number Two and number Six. When number Two goes, number Six goes as well.
Yeah.
And that kind of plays into something that I think is something they don't really get into, but I think it's a parallel you can draw, that Two is kind of a dark version of Six. Because they make it relatively clear that number Two is a company man who, you know,
oh, right, yeah.
Goes to the village, and in Chimes of Big Ben, he's like, oh, I know I'm a prisoner. I've just chosen to fall in line. And my vision is the vision of the whole village, as the whole world is the village.
Yeah. Yep.
And he's sort of, I've always seen that number Two as kind of a dark version of Six, where if Six had chosen not to rebel and had chosen to continue to follow the company line, he would end up like number Two.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. If he had focuses his, it comes down to the individual thing. Six is the individual. The other guy is the collective.
Yes,
like their energies are similar, but they're focused in different directions, I guess.
Right. And which I think that adds some credence to what you were saying about the death of Two ultimately means the death of Six as well,
mm-hmm.
but not in the same way.
Right.
Sort of a dark mirror death.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which is the name of my first... Post Fallout fan fiction of Prisoner.
That's my memoir title.
Dark Mirror Death.
Put this mirror up again.
You know what they should have done? They should have done a whole mirror episode where it was just everybody in mustaches and goatees.
Yep.
That would have been great.
McGoohan in the... Yeah. Well, I feel like that would be, that's a like a topic ripe for the Village. Like yeah. if you reversed everything, I feel like that's kind
bizarro
of a
Village.
Yeah, like a yeah. Bizarro Village. Like that would be. I don't know. Like what if the whole Village started pushing individualism? Would Six just be like, no, I hate this.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, actually.
Is he just a contrarian, or is he actually an individual? Like
at what
like,
point, if the whole Village is all about rebellion and anarchy, at what point does Number Six say, listen,
I've had enough of this.
We actually, you know, need to live as a civilization, so we can't all be assholes to everybody.
It's like the growth thing. It's like the Village becomes anarchic, and he's like, you know, the 20-something college kid who's like, yeah, man, I'm going to change the world. And then he hits his 30s and you're like, you know what? I just kind of want a house and I want to watch TV when I get home from
work. I would like to be able to support my family. So if you guys could just stop burning cars, that would be great. I got to get up early for work. I got to pick out a tie.
Come on, guys. Come on. Yeah, I think that would have been interesting. I'm surprised they didn't do that. Like a
season two, man.
Yeah.
That fictional season two. That's what, which was after the series is over, we will be covering fictional episodes that we've written in our heads.
Fanfic. 27 episodes of all the scripts you weren't fitting to print.
Number Six, please.
Why do you care?
I know your voice.
I have been here before. Why do you care?
You'll never know.
I'm realizing this is a difficult episode to describe the situations.
Yeah, it's really hard to talk about without seeing it. But
yeah,
kind of, like if you haven't watched the show and you're listening to this, prepare to not really understand what's going on.
No, well, it's very like the way that it sort of goes through the motions is like there are moments of distinctness, but it's really. I didn't find them that distinct. It was more like what I was saying earlier. It's like a slow build towards something.
Yeah.
And I'm having a hard time remembering the specifics of what they do. I do remember the end result is like, this is like ultimately what happens. That might've been, I don't know if I'm getting off, but it's like, that might've been my major criticism is I wish they had spent a little bit less time in the bunker thing.
Okay.
Even like if you shaved 10 minutes and had something else go in before that, maybe like if Six had started the episode going, because they kind of had that conversation where he's pacing around in his thing and Two calls him on the phone.
Yep.
But if they actually had a meeting in that room and then maybe in the
embryo room?
The dome thing where Two's office.
Oh, yeah, the green dome, yeah.
Right, so if Six had gone in there and like they'd been like, you'll never break me, and then they're like, oh, we'll do this, and then they knock him out after explaining what they're going to do, I feel like it would have been a little bit better because I think they spend a little bit too long in the theater room,
okay.
The bunker. That would be my one thing to fix because they're in there for really like 40 minutes almost. Like,
yeah,
there's very little time that they're not doing.
It's pretty much the whole episode.
Yeah. It ends with that very quick thing that's kind of seems to be the standard of the television of the era. It just kind of ends after we'll walk you out.
Yeah.
But I could have done with a little bit more lead in, although that would have undone the whole like the Village is at wit's end kind of thing. So I have a hard time trying to correct that, or not correct it, but come up with the way that I would have done it.
Yeah. No, I like it. I think it's really ballsy.
Mm.
Well, I don't know. I think it's ballsy by today's standards. It's definitely ballsy for the kind of show that they were doing. But the theatrical thing that he's doing is not uncommon on television at the time.
Yes.
Like they were doing a lot. I mean, back before there were real like shows to watch.
Yep.
Most of television was theater performances.
Yeah, I mean, even today, multi-camera sitcoms are pretty much theater. You know, you're in one set,
right.
And you do everything right there.
Right. But, you know, there was lots of, like, Orson Welles did a lot of television Shakespeare. And McGoohan himself was on a televised play called Brand. I think he was on one or two other ones as well. So it's not uncommon for television in general. But for a science fiction spy show?
Yeah, well, imagine if you were like, hey, I've heard about The Prisoner. Let me tune in. And this is what you came into. You'd go, I don't understand any of this. This makes no sense. It would, I think you'd think, if you had not been familiar with the show, you'd be like, this show sucks. If you if you came in on this episode.
Unless you just like really like avant-garde theater, then you'd be like, this is revolutionary.
I can't believe this didn't last the second season. But it's a weird episode in that way, in that it's like very much necessitated by what came before it. And the breakdown is non-specific, but makes sense because of everything we've seen before.
Right.
So I think that's why it's interesting to me. As an episode, I don't know if I would think it was that strong if you ripped it out of the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, I agree with everything you said about, I mean, the strength of it is based on everything we've seen up to that point. But I mean, it's tough to really... That's like saying, well, if you watched the second to last episode of The Sopranos...
Yep.
Would that hold up on its own? Probably not.
No.
Or anything for that matter.
You right, know? Yeah.
Because, I mean, so when you get to that point, so much is built on so much that's come before it.
Yeah.
When you're, you know, barreling into the ending. The only one that I'll give you is if you watched... I don't know if it's the second to last episode of Breaking Bad, but the one where, spoiler alert, they kill Hank.
Yep.
That episode's fucking great. You could pull that out. You could pull that out. And I mean, I was watching it with my girlfriend, and she only watched, you know, a smattering of episodes of Breaking Bad. And so she didn't know everything totally that was going on. And she watched the episode. She was like, wow, that was unbelievable.
Yep.
So there are instances in which it works, but generally if you're watching a show for the first time at the end of its series, it's not a great place to start.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I'm saying is I don't know. There's not really a self-contained arc to this episode.
Okay.
Like that's kind of why it feels very, hard to pinpoint things that have happened.
Yeah.
Like it's not, if you stripped away some of the, like if you took some of the other episodes, even the one before this, the girl who was death, right? That was one that was right before this?
Yes.
If you took that one and you explained sort of, this is what happens in this episode, you'd go, oh, there's like a story there.
Mm.
This one is much more, you kind of have to get broad. You have to say two is going to try to break six.
Yeah.
And they'll go, there's a story there. But if you specifically start going through it, it's like, ooh, that doesn't really sound like much of a narrative to what's going on.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's again, I think it's McGoohan playing to the strengths he knows that he has. I mean, I think he knows how good of an actor Liam McKern is, obviously.
Yep.
And he knows that he's no slouch himself. So he, for something that clearly he wrote quickly, and I'm sure they shot it for 8 days, I think.
No, yep.
I don't really know if that's long or if that's short as far as television. I mean, I guess that's including the 3 days that
of Leo writing. McKern... or the breakdown,
had
right?
to have a breakdown. Yeah. But, you know, it's like I said before, where some of the times that he's grabbed the reins directorially may not have been that he was just being an egomaniac. It may have been, I know how the show works. I know what it needs to look like. You've never directed the show before. This is one that needs a very specific feel to it. I'm just going to do this myself.
Yeah, and I think his episodes are generally the better directed ones.
Yeah.
I can't think of... I can't. He's done a bunch, but I can't remember them off the top of my head. But I feel like that's true.
Yeah, and I think it follows through to the entirety of this episode because he's putting all of the weight of, or I should say, all of the pressure of pulling it off is squarely on his and Leo McKern's shoulders.
Right.
You know, like, because like you said, the broad story is number two tries to break number six. But if you were to get into it, and like we said, if you look at the script, and the script would probably read like nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
But they can pull it off because, you know, they're both unbelievable actors.
Yeah, yeah.
And McGoohan, the thing that's so, another reason why I get kind of skeptical about people saying like, oh, he had no idea what was going on. The whole thing was a mess. It was just crazy and nothing made sense. He shot this episode sixth. He clearly knew where it was going.
Right, yeah.
This is the sixth episode.
What was the, we had that, how many episodes did McGoohan say were like, these are
seven.
The his definitive cuts or whatever?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, I can't remember exactly what they are, but it's like Arrival, this one, and Fallout, the last two.
Yep.
And I think Free For All.
Chimes.
Checkmate. Is that six? That's six. And Dance of the Dead, I believe, is the other
one. Oh, okay. Right.
But, I mean, you know, he wrote and shot this sixth out of 17. He clearly knew what the progression of the character and the story was going to be.
Yeah, well, I think you've mentioned it before. He planned on a 7-episode series, and then he's just like, you know, these are my 7. Like, yeah. He knows this is going to be the 6th episode.
Yeah.
Like, to him, like, yeah. It's not just because they shot at 6, but he's like, this is going to be the penultimate thing. And then they obviously had to fill in with some other, you know, the order got bought out for more episodes, and they had to create some more ideas. But yeah, because the arc through those episodes makes total sense.
Right.
And this one obviously makes total sense. It just happens to be 16 instead of 6.
And I think, you know, while I think clearly he knew what was going on, I was just thinking about it now. This episode works also because the stuff it's dealing with is actually pretty simple.
Yep.
Because all you really need to know to be able to write and execute this episode is you have to know number 6's character and his motivations. You have to know the village's motivations.
Yep.
Number 2's motivations. And you have to think, all right, well, this is going to be placed at a point where the village is, you know, has lost all grip.
Right.
Right. I mean, with all those things in mind, especially if you are the writer and actor of the character, you can probably extrapolate what all this shit's going to be.
You chose this method because you knew the only way to beat me was to gain my respect.
That is correct.
And then I would confide.
I hope that you would come to trust me.
This is a recognized method
used in psychoanalysis. The patient must come to trust his doctor. Totally.
Sometimes they change places.
Which is essential in extreme cases.
Also a risk.
Oh, grave risk.
If the doctor has his own problems.
I have.
That is why the system is known as degree absolute.
It's one or the other of us.
Why don't you resign?
You're very good. You're very good at it.
You just reminded me, I'm sorry to jump off, but you know how I've come up with my idea of how I would have shaved 10 minutes off.
Okay.
And it would have fit the theme. You show the village starting to fall apart, like the actual village. Like the villagers are starting to like break windows or something.
That's
like,
interesting.
And then it would go into, this is now, because everything has fallen apart, we now have to go to, what's it called?
Degree absolute. That's actually really fascinating. I think, the interesting thing there is, if that's happening, then you're tying in number 6 directly to the well-being of the village and the strength of the village.
Yeah.
And I think you are making, at that point, you are specifically saying that the whole thing is about him.
Yes.
Where you could make that argument regardless.
I think the show kind of hints at that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes as much. It doesn't make sense that the village exists for that reason, because the village seems to have existed into perpetuity outside of 6, but they seem super interested in 6.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I think I would be okay with that, because I think that works more on a metaphorical level than it needs to on a literal level. Because, yeah, if you go through the show and you're looking at it from the archetypes that they're playing with for the whole series,
yep.
I mean, the village does exist for the purpose of breaking 6.
Right.
And number 6 exists as the lone beacon to stand up against the village. So if number 6 is quote-unquote winning, it would make sense that the village is starting to fall apart.
Yeah.
So I would be okay with that, I think. It would be very interesting. You know, it's funny that you say that, because when I was watching it last night, there's a couple shots. The only two exterior shots of Port Marion are of that courtyard where the fountain is.
Yeah.
They're very, very long shots.
That's where he accosts the village guy.
Yeah, and then later they're wheeling him through there on a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did notice, I don't know if this is on purpose or if this is because they had to go back and do a pickup shot for it and they could only afford like 3 extras or something, but
it's
a very dreary looking shot and there's nobody there.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I was watching it last night, it occurred to me, I wonder if that was the kind of thing they were going for, where it's like, where it's usually all hustle and bustle.
Right, and the music and the marching.
Yeah, it's just a very dreary, nobody's around kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Huh. Well, I don't know if that was the intent, but it it actually kind of really, it's pretty cool if you think about it that way. But
now it is.
Yeah, now it is. Retconned. Hey, if the writer wants to call in and dispute that, I'm all ears.
What's his name? Seabass McGee?
But he can't because he's dead. R.I.P. Archibald Schwartz.
Archibald Schwartz, that's it. Archibald's a great name.
It is a good name.
Protect other people.
Why, Pop?
Pop goes the weasel.
Why?
Half a pound of fish.
Why, Pop?
So a little bit of trivia. We mentioned that McKern had a breakdown. We mentioned it was shot sixth. It's written in 36 hours. There's a point in the episode where it's when he's getting scolded by the headmaster of his school,
yeah,
or whatever. And number two says something that has, since its original airing, been a jumping off point for people who continue to try and find parallels between Danger Man and the Prisoner.
Sure.
And what they think he's saying to number six is, report to my study in the morning, Drake.
Okay.
That's not what he's saying. People have thought that's what he's saying for years, but it's not what he's saying. He's saying, report to my study in the morning break, as in between classes.
Okay.
Which is very, I mean, if you're trying to hear that, especially on a TV in the 60s.
And then he turns and he says, excuse me while I kiss this guy.
Yeah. You know, I've noticed that you're really into Danger Man.
And I was driving up and there's a wino down the road.
And there's also a bathroom on the right. But yeah, so that's you know, like I've talked about it before, it's fun to find these things, but with this show, I specifically wish that it was, people were looking for less ways to connect it and just kind of like stewing in what it actually gives you.
Sure.
Because there's so much stuff there to just, you know, digest that I don't think you need to go outside of it to really appreciate the show.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not drawing any negative comparisons here, but I mean, it's like the, like a truther movement, for example, like a conspiracy thing. Mm-hmm. Where you start the more connections you try to make, the more you're like, wow, this is a lot of connections.
Oh, absolutely!
I can't believe that all of this is actually working out.
Right.
So I think you're better if you choose, you know, your three main things and you stick with that. It's much easier to maintain a fiction, because everything's fiction. Right. It's much easier to maintain a fiction when you only have three angles you're going at.
Right, right. And I mean, if you never find out that the village is actually a metaphor for what chemtrails are doing to us, then it's probably good. Wait, hold on. Hold on a second. All right, Illuminati handshake. All right.
There was a helicopter flying overhead as we were recording earlier, so if this podcast is taken off the internet, you'll know exactly what happened. Big Brother.
And the only other thing, I haven't seen this episode, but apparently there is an episode of Babylon 5 in the second season, like it's a second season finale, I think,
Okay. That
is a direct reference to this, and that it's written in a very similar way and staged in a very similar way. I'll have to look into that and see if I can find it somewhere to watch it.
Sean, if you're listening, let us know what happened in Babylon 5.
So, I guess that's it for, Once Upon a Time. Do you have any final thoughts?
I like this episode. I don't really have any fun. I think it's a great way to round the third base, you know, to bring it home. As I said, I could have clipped it a little bit. I would have added a little bit of story at the head of it. The acting was fantastic. They certainly brought it, and yeah, I thought it was pretty solid. You know, it's a great summation of all the surrealness.
Yeah,
and I assume. Yeah. I'd have to assume we don't go back to the village as normal for the final episode.
It's safe to say that does not happen.
Okay.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you, do you have any thoughts or opinions going into the finale?
Well, yeah. Well, I thought it was going to go either one of two ways. It was either going to go, he was going to go back to the village and it would be somewhat normal, like, you know, a regular episode.
Right.
Or he... I could see it... I could see it being total nonsense. It's one of those two extremes. It's either a regular episode or it's like, this is just absurd at this point. Like, the storyline will be so surreal as to not be final. Like, I could see that happening. Those would be my two options.
Yeah. Interesting. I think those are both very reasonable options.
Is there a number two in the final episode?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right. So
I think that's a good answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll see what happens.
Yes with a question mark.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a great episode. I think it's the chances that McGoohan specifically takes in this episode, across the episodes he directs and writes in this series,
mm-hmm.
I wish more shows did. Because, I mean, all the ones that he writes and directs are the ones that are most unlike anything else you'll see on TV. Like, he did this one, Many Happy Returns, which is the one in the boat where it's mostly on a boat in silence. Free for All, which is...
The voting.
Yeah, the voting. He was really open to taking chance. He saw the opportunity he had with this show, and he just got as much out of it as he could.
Did he write every episode he directed?
I don't think so.
Don't think so.
I think there's... Well, he unofficially directed a couple that he didn't write.
Okay.
But the big ones he did.
Okay.
I think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, we'll add this in the notes.
I don't think he wrote Many Happy Returns.
Okay.
I'll have to double check. But yeah, whatever. Anyway.
Sure.
Yeah, I think he saw his opportunity with the show that he had, and he did his best to exploit it. And I think, you know, it's better for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it makes it a really interesting show to watch.
Hmm.
But yeah, that's it for Once Upon a Time. We're going to be rounding it out next week. And
we'll be happily living ever after. It's not called that, right?
What's it's called Fallout.
Fallout. That's stupid. They should have called it, and we are happily ever after.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
We've got the Star Trek podcast. You can go to thepenskypodcast.com. A lot of TNG Star Trek episodes. We are blitzkrieging through. And if you want to go to YouTube, there's the Penske file. You can find a bunch of content on there.
Cool. And again, I am not an expert on any of this. So if you'd like to contact me and yell at me about things I've gotten wrong, or if you'd like to just, hey, you just want to talk about The Prisoner for a bit, we're open to that too. We'd love to chat about this. You can email us at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @prisonerpodcast. If you happen to be listening to us on iTunes and you feel so inclined to give us a rating or review, preferably a positive one, we would be much obliged.
Are we going to do a giveaway for our final? We should come up with a giveaway contest. That's always huge. You'll have one. So we have like a mug. what's that class?
Actually, you know, we could do a giveaway. I have a print of a prisoner draw, number 6 drawing that I did. I could mail that out to somebody.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, that's it for Once Upon a Time. We will see you next time with the series finale of The Prisoner called Fallout. Thanks for listening and hope to be back next week. Otherwise, it'll be a really unsatisfying end of the series for you.
Unfortunate.
See you guys later.
See ya.
Well, there you go. There was Once Upon a Time. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. And, you know, I think we're going to work out the details of that prisoner print giveaway that we talked about towards the end, and we'll have some more details next week. And next week, like any good fairy tale that starts with Once Upon a Time, it must also come to an end, which the Prisoner series does with the episode Fallout. So we'll see you next time. Bye.